I thought we'd have a short class for a lot of reasons, your activities and my activities. And I thought of addressing a couple of points that I thought would be practical for all of you. I'm trying to remember who it was, but just very recently, while I was in Dallas for a meeting, someone sent a letter asking one of those kind of questions that we have our teachings that are like this, and there's other people who I associate with in the workplace whose teachings are like that. And one of those how-to questions, how to communicate what our teachings are when our teachings are not like, in fact, their teachings, without going into details, are largely impersonal. The goal is, and it may not be, they may not even know what the goal is, without naming the names, but commonly, the goal is something impersonal. And the ultimate analysis, it's all one. Like that. And then something that's related but different but related is there are many gods, which means there's no God, but there's many gods. And people that have that kind of upbringing or faith or not so much thought through, just that's their, how they, when they think of spirituality, that's how they think of spirituality. So in due course of time, progressively, it would be very nice to have some systematic study programs. We have study programs, but systematic study programs, so that what's in the faith, I'm speaking in a general way, the here in St. Louis, the devotees that are participating have some basic faith in the process of devotional service. Perhaps not a clear understanding of exactly why and where, you know, more of the what, but not so much of the why. These are things that we do, but why do we do the things that we do? From a scriptural perspective, perhaps, not such a clear understanding. So, when we're mixing or encountering with persons that have a different understanding and therefore maybe even a similar practice or a different practice, how do we dialogue with those persons? Certainly we don't dialogue with those persons with a stick in our hand saying us and them. That's not what we do. But if there's some interest on the part of the other person, it's helpful not just to say, well, this is how we do things, but is there a scriptural basis for why we do the things we do and the understanding that's behind the things that we do? So at least when you have some dialogue with those individuals, you're minimally, this is that now what I'm about to describe is the intermediate stage of devotion, where faith is firm. I may not know all the scriptural whys and wherefores, but my faith is firm. Whereas in the beginning of the three stages, faith is soft and pliable. Faith is firm, but I may not have all scriptural understandings why. And progressively, I'm very clear what the scriptural basis of why and therefore what. We do what we do because. And I was thinking of giving an example from Bhagavad Gita and taking that message from Bhagavad Gita to the platform of Srimad Bhagavatam. I did a little survey on several occasions to find out, before persons came to Krishna consciousness, what would they say, or what did they say, was a verse that expresses the essence of Bhagavad Gita. So, Hare Krishna devotees know 1866. Sarva dharmam parityaja mamikam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mukhyishami ma suchaha. So we all know that one. But before we knew that one, or others that had some exposure to Bhagavad Gita, what verse do they think, or did they think, did we think, was the essence message of Bhagavad Gita? Anyone? Huh?
247,
exactly. Karmanyevadikaraste mafaleshu kadachana. What's Krishna saying? You have the right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of your work. Read the translation, a little bit of the purport. Ma karma pala hetu bhur ma te sango stha akarmani. Karma and akarma. Freedom from bondage of your work. You have the right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of your action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities. That's a good one. And never be attached to not doing your duty. It's another good one. Certainly appropriate for Arjuna, because that was his program. That was his... He was stuck in not wanting to do what was his duty, because he had another idea of what it was his duty, and so he didn't want to do what his duty was. On many levels he didn't want to. That which was his nature, remember from the class yesterday evening, or was it this morning? Swabhava, there are two ways, yeah, last night, ways by which one's position is understood by karma and guna. Chaturvarnya maya shristam guna karma vibhagasha. Remember that? Krishna says that shrishta, maya shrishta. I created the system of varna. And the basis of varna, that's your occupation. Brahman, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra, that's varna. And ashram is brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, that's ashram, but varna is your occupation. Your occupation is determined by Krishna's created it in terms of guna and karma, the modes of nature with which you associate, and your previous activities. Then you get a body, and with that body, impulses born of the modes of material nature. So yesterday evening we discussed the term swabhava, which means your nature. It's the modes of nature. Conditioned, not your spiritual. The spiritual swabhava is something else. Sanatan dharma. But there's the conditional one. What is my nature? And then we have duties according to our nature. Things that we should do and things that we shouldn't do, according to our nature. I'm a sannyasi. Wouldn't be right if I went out and got a job and did those kinds of things. And if a grihastha didn't go out and get a job, that wouldn't be right. Etc. So there are things that we do and don't do according to our ashram and according to our varna. So don't, the advice that Krishna, the last part that Krishna is advising is you should never be a time when you do not perform your work, your duty. Even in the liberated stage, because that's one of Arjuna's things, one of his tacit arguments. Well, if I have my duty, then maybe if I become liberated, then I won't have to do this anymore. And how am I going to get liberated is to get knowledge. Then I'll get liberated, then I don't have to do this anymore. But he still has a body and he still has a nature and has to perform work according to his nature. Even in a liberated state of consciousness, where the consciousness, like Suja's question this morning about one whose consciousness is beyond the conception of the body, you still have duties. According to Krishna's instruction in Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, to teach by example. You're not obliged to get out of the bondage of karma, but you're obliged to show by example those that are in the bondage of karma. So we all have a duty to do. And don't be neglectful of what those duties are. That's Krishna's advice. Now we're going back up. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your work. Even though you're doing your work, don't consider yourself to be the cause of the fruits of your work. What's the cause of the fruits of your work? It's material nature under the supervision of Krishna. Karmana daiva netrena. Under the supervision of daiva, there's the fruits of work through the agency of material nature. Material nature produces fruits, not we. But so to think otherwise is acting through false ego, and false ego is, I think I'm this body. Just like the discussion yesterday evening, those who think they're this body, they're captured by unwanted things such as fear or kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsarja. How do you overcome those things? Get rid of the bodily conception. Stop acting in false ego. What's that? Act in the conception of the soul. What do souls do? So that's the first part. They perform their prescribed duty, but they're not attached to being the enjoyer of the fruits of their work. So it's not what Arjuna wanted was karma tyag. And Krishna is saying, no, karma phala tyag. You're entitled to perform your prescribed duty. In fact, you must perform your prescribed duty. You're entitled to do your prescribed duty, and that's karma free, provided you don't consider yourself to be the enjoyer of the fruits, nor the producer of the fruits, because that which you produce, the tendency is there to think I'm entitled to enjoy it. I'm entitled to enjoy this house because it's mine. And how did it become mine? I work. I get a paycheck and I saved up a bunch of money and I made a down payment. Bank gave me a mortgage and look, now it's mine. I'm making my mortgage payments, I'm paying the insurance payments, I'm paying the electric bill out of my work. I'm the enjoyer of the fruits of my work. And then my stuff that's in my house. And so on and so on. And Krishna is putting the brake pedal on that one. But I am entitled to perform my prescribed duty. And in the entitlement to perform my prescribed duty, what do I do with the fruits? Because there's the refrigerator. There's the kitchen stove. And there's the, you know, the different parts of the house. What do I do? The fruits are dedicated to the service of Krishna. That's how you remain detached. You have to do something with the fruits. You dedicate them to the service of Krishna. But supposing that's the understanding of persons that have had the association of devotees or a Vaishnava of some kind. But supposing one hasn't had the association of a Vaishnava of some kind, like the people that you may meet here and there. I mean, these days a lot more devotees are going on Sankirtan, their book distribution, and meeting people that they have these kinds of dialogues. Or in the workplace and they have these kind of dialogues. Or different functions and you have these. So some of those persons haven't had the association of Vaishnavas. So how do they read this one? They read it either one of those two ways that I mentioned previously. It's the goal is to become one with the Supreme. So this is a means for that. So how do they get the idea of that? It's just Krishna disappears. The personality of Godhead disappears. Because what I want is not a relationship with the personality of Godhead. What I want is, I want out of here. I want release from the bondage of the fruits of my work. Because the light went on that said, I'm doing these religious activities and that's going to increase my prosperity in this life and life after this life. That means there's life after this life. There's something beyond this life. There's the soul. And one becomes interested in knowledge of the soul and then liberation of the soul and reading Bhagavad Gita with that, through that light. I want liberation. Moksha. Krishna isn't in the picture yet because I haven't had association with devotees yet. And you're the devotee who is supposed to, by Krishna's arrangement, have some interaction with that person that hasn't had association with the devotee yet. And you speak one language and they speak another language. You somehow have to communicate. At least you have a conception and they have a different conception. One conception is this conception that says, I want to become one with the Supreme. Absolute oneness with the Supreme. Kevala Advaita. Got a nice name. Absolute monism. And I read Bhagavad Gita. And when I read Bhagavad Gita, I perform my prescribed duty. I'm not attached to the result. I don't consider myself the cause of the results of my work. And I never cease from the performance of my duty. Because what's my duty? Is to become one with the Supreme. I'm doing that all the time. And I do my duties to do that, to get that. This, to get that. And when I get that, then I don't have to do this anymore. I'm liberated. And anything that helped me get there, I can discard it later. Tell a little Prabhupada story that helps illustrate this. The impersonalists have an example that you may use a ladder to climb to get to a certain height, and when you've reached a certain height, you can throw away the ladder. You don't need the ladder anymore because you're there. And so Prabhupada was teaching his devotees this lesson one time. They were helping Prabhupada go down the bank. There's a Bhaktisiddhanta Road and our Mayapur Center across the street at a time where weren't all those zillion shops across the street with all the commotion and dirt and noise. It was just an embankment because the river Ganges would come up to a certain height during flood season or rainy season and recede, and then it was just agricultural land, so long, steep bank. So these strong devotees went down first. One devotee put up his arm to allow Prabhupada to lean on his arm as he went down to the bottom. And when he got down to the bottom, Prabhupada pushed his arm like that. And the devotee thought, I don't know what I did. Did I offend Prabhupada? He wasn't. And said, Prabhupada, did I do something wrong? He said, this is impersonalism. One takes the help of a spiritual master to get liberated and then throws the spiritual master away. Now I'm God. So I may apply myself to naishkama karma, work without fruitive desire or fruitive intention, but that's just to get me to the place where I'm Brahman. I become one with Brahman. Then I don't have to worry about my duties anymore. I become God. And literally they address each other in that way. Om Narayana. Or that's less common. Those are, say, more staunch Mayavadis. A step down, just as a step before Mayavad, to say that there's many gods. Those who are worship of the many gods, pantheism or polytheism, they have another idea. They want to be enjoyers of the fruits of their work. But they recognize that there is bondage in that. That's problematic. And so this verse says something different to them. But we're devotees and we're encountering people that have this conception or that conception and different garden varieties of those main ideas. So now I'm going to go to Srimad Bhagavatam, two verses, where Narada is instructing Vyasadeva in chapter 5 of Canto 1. In chapter 4 of Canto 1, Sutta Goswami is being asked by the sages of Naimisharanya, this message of Srimad Bhagavatam is so wonderful, because that was spoken about at the end of chapter 3. This message of Srimad Bhagavatam is so wonderful. Could you describe how it appeared? What were the circumstances of how Srimad Bhagavatam appeared in this world? And some other questions. So, Sutta describes Vyas compiling Srimad Bhagavatam. So chapter 4 is not only Srimad Bhagavatam, but the whole of the Vedas. Vyasadeva, Mahamuni Vyas, you know this description. He is a literary incarnation of the Supreme Lord, and he's Trikala Gya. Kala means time. So that the three phases of time are past, present, and future. Trikala Gya. He's a knower of past, present, and future. We don't even know what's going on presently. People keep asking me, what's going on with your knee? I know something, but I don't know the whole something. I'm going back to New York tomorrow so they can do an MRI so they can say what's going on with my knee. So I'll know something more than what I know today, tomorrow. We don't know what's going on now fully and properly. How do we digest our food? Prabhupada describes. How do our fingernails grow? The scientists can't, they have no description, no explanation of how from flesh bone grows. No explanation. Somehow or another, we're finding out. And so on. We're not aware fully of what's going on at the moment, what to speak of past and future. But Vyas is a perfect knower of past, present, and future. He's an incarnation of God. So he looked into the future and he saw Kali Yuga and he went, ah, awful. Such miserable conditions people will be enduring. And it's just around the corner, just after Krishna leaves. So wanting to do something about that condition that hadn't happened yet, being a literary person, he compiled the Vedas. He took the one Veda that was in sound form and put it in written form, because people in Kali Yuga wouldn't have very good memories, if you haven't noticed. Prabhupada's teaching is, in Kali Yuga, good memory means write it down. It's a good principle. Good memory means write it down. There's something that's really important for you to make sure, write it down. And don't forget where you wrote it down. Hare Krishna. So, he wrote it down. And it describes, you know, his taking the one Veda, dividing into four, then writing Vedanta Sutra, and then writing the Mahabharata, and then the Puranic literature, the Smriti portion, and chapter 4 ends with his not feeling satisfied after all of that, and chapter 5 begins, Narada tells him why. And that one of the verses that I want to speak about is from that section. Essentially, he said that you've given inordinate, that's a nice vocabulary word. Do you know what inordinate means? Too much. That's what it means. Inordinate. You've given too much emphasis on fruitive activities. Well, it's Vedic. It's part of the Vedic wisdom. It's part of the original Veda. And you compiled it. So it's, you didn't make it up. You did a good job. But too much emphasis on how to take material tendencies, connect them to some type of sacrifice, and uplift that living entity that has grosser material desires to more to the quality of goodness, and in that quality of goodness to gain piety, pious credit, and thus prosper in this life and go to the heavenly realm in the next life. It's all Vedic, so it's okay. It's not non-Vedic, but too much emphasis on that. Because people of this age, they already have propensity to do that, and you've pretty much given it a rubber stamp saying it's okay. Go for it. Enjoy piously. Emphasis on piously, but the subtext is enjoy. Enjoy sense gratification piously. Do it nicely. In the mode of goodness, under the codes of the Vedas. Not sufficient emphasis on the ultimate purpose of that is elevation, but if the purpose of elevation is not to become a better enjoyer, the purpose of elevation is to go beyond the cycle of birth and death, that kind of elevation. So beyond the platform of fruit activities is the soul, and beyond the platform of the soul connected with the Supreme, and it's ultimately its devotional service to the Supreme. You haven't given sufficient emphasis on the goal, the personality of Godhead. So, Bhagavatam 1.5.12 says, Naishkarmyam. Recognize that? Naishkarma or karma pala tyag, same thing. Renouncing the fruits of work. Another term that says the same thing is naishkarmya. Without fruitive intention, without fruitive work. That's perform your duty without the intention of becoming the enjoyer of the fruits of your duty. That's naishkarmya. So, Naishkramyam api achuta bhavam varjitam nashopate jnanam alam niranjanam kutat punak shashvad abhadram ishware na charpitam karma yad apyakaranam. Naishkramyam api achuta bhavam. Achuta bhava. Affection for the achuta, the infallible Supreme Lord. Varjitam means devoid of. Achyuta bhavam varjitam, minus. Zippo, none. No affection for the personality of Godhead. Fruitive activities. Here's the translation. Knowledge of self-realization, even though free from all material affinity, naishkarmyam, knowledge of self-realization, even though free from all material affinity, does not look well if devoid of a conception of the infallible, achyuta bhava. So there are, going back to this Bhagavad Gita verse 247 and how it's interpreted by those who want to become one with the Supreme, they may become very skilled, very disciplined, very expert at performance of duty in the mood of detachment because of knowledge and aspiring for self-realization. It may be, you know, they've risen high in that field of activity. Now, in this age, that's not common, but those that do that, the Bhagavatam is saying, doesn't look so good. That's very gentlemanly. It's wrong. Doesn't look so good. Nashobhate doesn't look good. Shubha and ashubha, you know the terms. Auspicious and inauspicious. Nashobhate, it doesn't look so good. Then, what to speak of, then, what is the use of fruitive activities which are naturally painful in the very beginning and transient by nature if they are not utilized for the devotional service of the Lord? Kuta puna shashvat abhadram ishvare. Again, abhadram and abhadra. Auspicious and inauspicious. So, if this approach of self-realization, even if free from fruit of intention, if one's heart has managed to somehow accomplish that, nashobhate, it doesn't look so good. If it's devoid of a conception of the infallible Supreme Lord, if it's impersonalism, then what to speak of fruitive activities, which are painful in the beginning, and painful in the middle, and painful in the end. You just put some perfume on it and make it a little bow and ribbon. Make it look nice. But it's the painfulness is especially in terms of the soul. The soul's forgetfulness of that loving relationship with the Supreme. It's just, that's painful. It's painful. So, again, the context of explaining this is, speaking on these points is, supposing you're in a situation where you're called upon by someone who is reasonably curious, reasonably sincere, to want to know, why do you do what you do? Well, we do what we do because Maharaj said to do what we do. Prabhupada said to do what we do. Oh, okay. I'm convinced. But some persons may need something more. They may need, you know, well, why do you do what you do? And why don't you do this other? And if you're not equipped, you might feel a little uncomfortable. I don't know the answer why. So it's good that you know, not for the purpose of winning an argument or beating them with a stick, but for the purpose of, if you show you're very clear your purpose, and you know it's not just adults in your workplace or something like that, it's also our young devotees here who, you know, why do we do what we do? Why don't we do some of those other things that the other people do? And I was thinking about that on the way over here. Particularly in relation to our, when we were in Dallas, one of the topics that we spoke about was how to make Krishna consciousness relatable to people who are indigenous Americans, as opposed to specifically the non-resident Indians who are now perhaps also American citizens, but European, you know, the white bodies that have been living here in America. How do we make Krishna consciousness relatable to them? And because it's easier, in one sense, it's easier for persons who, like most all of you, who, at least as adults, you're practicing Krishna consciousness because it was easily relatable. And then there's your children. That's not the same. It's easily relatable because they got their friends and there's, you know, but there's all kinds of other stuff going on out there too that's, what about that? What about, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? So it's as parents and as children and as devotees, it's helpful to know why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do. What's the platform upon which it rests, the why. So that you can interact in these situations where, at least from your inner convictions, it's not a blind following, I'm following on the basis of I have some understanding. I'm presenting from that position, with that purpose in mind. So there's another verse in the second chapter of the first canto of Bhagavatam where the same idea is presented. In the second chapter is a fantastic chapter to learn because it presents fundamentals that the whole rest of the Bhagavatam are supported by. There's examples, like here, it's Vyasa Narada and some interaction, and it's Puranic, there's history. And the second chapter is just principle, and the history rests upon a principle. The history also explains the principle, elucidates the principle, but the principles are found in chapter 2, the principles of bhakti. Very, very nice chapter. Read it again and again and again, and discuss it with one another, and very nice. So here's one of the verses. Dharma prochita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. No, that's not the verse. That's another verse in the first chapter. Dharmasya hi apavargasya narto tayopakalpate nartasya dharmaikantasya kamo labhaya hi smritaha. Which means, it's two parts. Dharma, so going back to chapter 2, text 47, where Krishna says you're entitled to perform your prescribed duty. So that's one sense of what dharma is. It's prescribed duty. A sannyasi does this, a householder does that, a brahmachari does this, and a vanaprastha does that, and they're different duties. A brahmana does this, a kshatriya does that, and so on. There's duties. So, the performance of duties, dharmasya, hi, means certainly, for its emphasis. Dharmasya, hi, apavargasya. And apavarga is the opposite of pavarga. Pavarga is fruitive activity, parishrama, hard labor. And apavarga is without fruitive intention, or like this naishkarmya term that I mentioned from chapter 5. Apavarga is liberation. So the verse is saying that duty is certainly to be performed for ultimate liberation. Dharmasya hi apavargasya, and then it says it negative. Dharmasya hi apavargasya narto tayopakalpate. Never should it be performed for the purpose of gaining some material facility. Dharma, for the purpose of artha, economic development, for the purpose of kama, sense gratification. Never. This is the Bhagavatam speaking. Now that's not what people are used to hearing. They're used to hearing it, that's what you're supposed to do it for. You do dharma so you can get artha, so you can get kama. The Bhagavatam is saying, no, never. Only for one thing, ultimate liberation. And then a kind of checkmate. After that move, there comes the next move that says, Nartasya dharma kantasya. Supposing you're doing your dharma, you didn't do it to get something, some piety and with the piety, some facility with the facility. Hey, some opportunity to enjoy. No. If that opportunity comes of its own accord, never should it be used in sense gratification, but only in service to the Supreme. Supposing your nice devotional practice leads you to, in one way or another, to prosperity, or even just say in the circle of devotees, you do something very nicely, and then comes some appreciation. Oh, you've done very nicely. Then what happens? Pride. I've done very nicely. And if people don't recognize I've done very nicely, how come they're not recognizing I did very nicely? Because pride enters the heart. It's a double contamination. Doing with the intention, and even without the intention, if it comes, then trying to be the enjoyer of that. And frustrated if that opportunity for enjoyment doesn't come. So it requires really then a fixed sense of purpose in the execution of dharma. And what's that fixed sense of purpose? The Bhagavatam's indication is Param Satyam Dhimahi. It's becoming fixed upon the personality of Godhead as the object, the goal of my life, taking shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. Just hearing Prabhupada in a recorded lecture today, speaking about the first nine cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam are to prepare one to understand who is Krishna. And then he appears in the tenth canto. And then he performs his wonderful leelas. But if you don't understand who is Krishna, when he appears, you'll understand differently. Fiction, mythology, maybe a moral lesson or two, maybe something like that. But not understanding who is Krishna. So he was explaining that just as the father of Krishna is Vasudev. And Vasudev means pure. And so when Krishna, when your consciousness is pure, Vasudev, Krishna will appear. It's very simple. And until consciousness is pure, Krishna doesn't appear. We want to have that result of relationship with Krishna, lotus feet of Krishna, shelter in Krishna. So we have to make our consciousness pure. And to make our consciousness pure, then we'll go back down. We need to perform our duties in the proper way, with the proper understanding what the purpose of them is. It's not to become one with Supreme Brahman. It's not to become the enjoyers of our pious fruits in this life and the next. It's to purify our existence so that we're qualified that Krishna will appear. And Krishna will appear. Actually, Krishna has appeared in the form of the holy name, in the form of his wonderful Srimad Bhagavatam. It's actually not different than Krishna in his deity form and so on. But our consciousness isn't pure, and for that reason we don't recognize Krishna when he appears, although we're in contact. So the chanting and other direct devotional activities, side by side with how we perform our duties in life, how we direct those activities under the codes of scripture, under the guidance of a qualified teacher, for the satisfaction of Krishna, that brings us the purification necessary so that side by side, as we're chanting, we'll experience. Our relationship with Krishna, or even a fragmental portion of the natural happiness that's the happiness of the soul. Even a glimmer, even a speck, a drop of that happiness is something we all want. And the means, very mercifully, is being provided. Just apply ourselves. And the process is gradual because we have our attachments, and that's okay. Acknowledge the attachments and apply yourself gradually according to your capacity. And gradually purification. And gradually that experience. So this is some of the scriptural foundation. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. Why are we doing what we're doing? Why are we worshipping Krishna in the way that we're worshipping Krishna? The understanding is found here. So as you progress in spiritual life, don't just... It's good that you have faith that somebody has gone through the exercise of looking what the scripture says and they're convinced, so that's good enough for me. And that's a good beginning, having faith in those that have done all of that brahminical work. But in course of time, each of you need to also do that with proper guidance so that you can have that very firm, based upon scripture, conviction of why we do what we do. And on that basis, compassionately, give the opportunity of Krishna consciousness to others to your capacity. But that's part of, it's the message of Lord Chaitanya to Kurma Brahman, and in turn to everyone, to all of us. Make your life successful by receiving and then giving. And that's Krishna consciousness. That's Lord Chaitanya's method of bringing auspiciousness into this world. That's your duty. Receive and give. Receive nicely, give nicely. Receive regularly, then you'll give more nicely, because the purity will follow. And the more you exhibit that, or you carry that quality of purity, the more the opportunity will come to you. You will desire to seek it out, that is the opportunity to give, share Krishna consciousness with others, and Krishna will bring it to your door anyway. Even if you don't go out your door, Krishna will give you the opportunities how to share this wonderful experience through the wisdom of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and the process of devotional service. Okay. We're going to stop there and see if there's some discussion. Yes.
You're talking about the Varnashrama and the Varna occupation, and does it come from the birth?
No. That was discussion last night. Not by Janma, but by Guna and Karma.
Yeah.
the modes of nature with which you associate. Just like Prahlad Maharaj. By Janma, very bad. But that wasn't the disqualification or qualification. It wasn't his birth.
Yes, but it was misinterpreted in India, like all the like sutras born in that family become sutra, and Brahmins who were born in that family become Brahmins. So that is the classification they say that Varnasrama.
I know, they say. And we don't accept. I gave another example. You were listening, right?
Yeah.
The Navayogendras. They were sons of a king, but they were beyond the Varnashram system because of their qualification. They're sons of Rishabdev.
Yeah.
He's a Kshatriya. He's by his birth. And so by birth, they were Kshatriyas. But some of his sons became Brahmanas, some of his sons became Kshatriyas, and some of the sons became beyond the whole system by their qualification.
One more thing is that self-realization, like what will be the outcome of this self-realization? Like we realize...
Well, it depends if you're a devotee or not. So from the perspective of a devotee?
Yeah, from a devotee means, yeah.
Simply expressed, Prabhupada's words are that self-realization and God-realization occur simultaneously. Like seeing oneself and seeing the sun occur simultaneously. So self-realization implies God-realization. God-realization includes self-realization. Say it the other way. Self-realization without God-realization isn't self-realization. It's incomplete. What if your daughter got a grade on her report card that said incomplete? Of course, that wouldn't happen. Supposing that was the grade, you would ask, what happened? And some explanation. But it's not, you know, she didn't fail. She didn't pass either. Just incomplete. So, self-realization without God-realization, it's incomplete. It's a beginning, but it's not complete. To have some understanding of the soul beyond the body and to engage oneself in naishkarmya, non-fruitive intention and work, that is, the intention is liberation, that the other kind of liberation, merging with the supreme kind of liberation, sayujya mukti, without a conception of the supreme person, it's incomplete. Or nishobhate. It doesn't look so good.
So, if a devotee, then his goal should be a self-realization?
The goal should be, that's a subset. But that beyond the subset is the whole. The whole is that re-establishing our loving relationship with Krishna. With that is self-realization. That's a subset. Okay. Something else? Yes.
This is about the devotional service. So if somebody asks, like, talk about that, about our philosophy, and then finally we say that our constitutional position for the soul is like the servant of Krishna. So it means like doing devotional service as a part of our duty. It means like how I can explain or make to understand, give more details of that.
Not so much details of that, because the details is how you do your RT and so forth and so on. So it's the principle or the essence of that. The principle or essence is everything is dedicated to Krishna. I'm doing my duty as a householder to my family and my husband and daughter, and I'm doing my duties. But they're all dedicated to the satisfaction of Krishna. Now, that in itself is karma yoga. But for some people, that's a good beginning. Because it's not, the detail hasn't been presented of how you do your sadhana. Because you add the regulative principles of bhakti to karma yoga, and you just comes into another category of yoga. But you can just describe the dedication of those duties unto the Supreme Lord. And people may say, oh, I do that too. And I've got so many lords. This one, that one. But depending upon the person, you know, you can have carry the dialogue on further. Depends on the person, how you carry the dialogue on further. Let's say, take a principle and say, okay, in our family we eat. We eat, you eat, they eat. So, how do we dedicate that to God? Then you can describe the principle of how that's done. There's so many details, but there's a principle. The fruits of one's work are then used to go to the marketplace thinking, let me purchase something for Krishna. And you bring back to the kitchen and you make it clean because it's going to be prepared for Krishna. And you're thinking that as you're preparing it, this is going to be offered to Krishna. And then you offer it to Krishna. And that's a very different consciousness than thinking, my husband and daughter, they like these kinds of foods, and so I'll buy those kinds of things and cook for them, and they'll like those. God isn't in the center. But the devotional practice is that God is in the center. It may be even the very same items that are being cooked, but the consciousness is that Krishna be pleased. And the cultivation of that is the essence of bhakti. It's a transferring of that attachment from matter to spirit. The same principle of attachment from matter to spirit. From the body to the soul and the soul's connection with the Supreme. Some persons can't get it. It's too subtle. It just goes right through their... They don't get it. But you cultivate like that, and it becomes... The quality with which it becomes a strength with which you speak, not the volume or how forceful you are when you say it, but purity is the force. If you live your life that way, the message comes through because you live your life that way. Something? Yes. Bill.
Early on in the lecture, you were talking about be able to articulate and understand why
we do what we do.
Right. Is that just in case in the event I were to get like a philosophical discussion with if somebody at a Baitin or somebody from the Arya Samaj or something?
Maybe.
Able to articulate.
That's not primarily. Actually, the reason for speaking in that way is because in the past 3 weeks, I've had several very sincere persons present that real-life situation where they're in the workplace or they're in their, wherever their social circumstance, and they're in some dialogue with somebody that doesn't see the way that we see. And they want to be able to share it, not like win a debate, but they want to be able to share it effectively. But at the same time, they don't want to misrepresent, and they don't want to win as opposed to lose. They want to properly, effectively share. When they recognize the persons have a very different conception. I mean, I could give examples of some dialogue, but I'd kind of rather not. Because we're being recorded. Just different situations that people find themselves in. I'm saying essentially here two things. If there's purity of your own practice and convictions, and there's scriptural basis for why, then the communication can go very smoothly. And the goal is not to have the other person say yes instead of no, or maybe, it's just to effectively share. If the sharing is coming from a place of purity, that purity in itself is attractive, even if the person says no. Their heart may say yes, because purity is powerful. Purity is the force. So how we express ourselves in social circumstances where, unless the person is offensive or something like that, but more compelling is our own purity and our own quality than precisely the words that we speak. But the words that we speak, if at the same time they're supported by or on the basis of Scripture, that carries its strength also. I've had the experience where those kinds of exchanges result in the individual going back and studying their own texts more carefully, because they haven't. Anyway, what the purpose is, just stating it again, to help the person, the devotees here, become fixed in Madhyama Adhikari qualification. Their faith becomes nurtured by the statements, clear statements from the Scripture. So not just on this one particular point, but in general, when going forward in time, because all of you are practicing, to carry your practices to another level gradually, become very, tune in to what the message is, so that you can internalize it and so that you can express it, receive it and give it. That's what I meant from this other thing. Not just win an argument with the Mayavadi. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, in the beginning our faith is soft and pliable.
Yeah.
And we may be doing certain things and we're not even... and we're not clear about the reason why.
Yeah.
But as we associate with those that are faithful, our faith grows.
Yes.
But it takes a certain amount of faith to continue to associate with devotees.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we find that there isn't that faith. So how can we be of service in such a situation?
Well, you can start with purity. That's a lifetime's job. Because when there's purity, then those things that... Like text 5 of Nectar of Instruction, where Rupa Goswami is teaching how we offer different qualities or degrees of respect. And the first one he mentions is one who even chants Krishna's name once, there to be respected amongst the total population. Those that regularly chant and have been initiated in the chanting of the holy name, another level of respect. So, by purification, one goes further and further into the spiritual reality and further away from the duality, as you put it, those things that may keep us from wanting to regularly associate. Because if our consciousness goes to the spiritual side, then we can always be of service, which was your question, depending upon the person, the situation, the details. Our inspiration to be of service. Very easily comes out because of that purity. You got a little piece of paper? Is this from you?
No.
No? Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
This sort of interaction with the colleagues at the workplace or something like that, does it become sixth offense, like instructing the faithless person?
I got about 50% of what you said. Could you do it again?
The interaction such as in the workplace and other
places.
Yes,
okay.
Encounter it, does it become an sixth offense, like that, instructing the faithless person about the glories of
the... We don't instruct the faithless person about the glories of the holy name unless they show there's some faith. We can encourage them in a simple way, and that's not the sixth offense. It's like our invitation cards. Chant the holy name and be happy. Chant the holy name and your life will be sublime. Chant the holy name and free yourself from material miseries. Chant the holy name. We can say that's something that we do because it brings happiness and brings purification of heart. That's fine. Yeah?
Even though we're not at the topmost stage of devotion, there is some level of, there is some love for the spiritual master. And so some of the things we do, we're simply doing because of that relationship.
Okay.
So it takes a certain level of maturity to, in these interactions with others where, we might or we might not express why we do what we do.
That's okay. Nonverbal communication, specific communication and interaction is fine. That the main thing is that your heart is properly aligned. Does that address your question? Not exactly.
So, should I just have faith that as I hear and chant, that level of maturity will develop as to how to share the why? In some situations, some persons have enough faith for me to just say...
I see. Well, you practice. Krishna gives intelligence, and you practice. And you can, if circumstance permits, you can observe how experienced devotees do. And that gives you some indications. But then we're all individual, and different persons are going to do it in a different way. Okay, back to Suja. You have your second question.
This is about the soul in the liberated stage. My understanding is like the soul at that stage should be free from the both sinful and the pious activities.
Yes, yam tvantagatam papam. Yes, jananam punyakarmanam. You know the verse. Okay, so?
That's what my question is.
Yes, liberated, that's what it means. Yes, that's what it means. In other words, they may be engaged in proper activity, but it's not karma. It's not pious karma. When Arjuna was carrying out his prescribed duty, it was for Krishna. You had another question.
No, my question is with that related, like how to be free from. I'm not any father, but just to know and to understand that, how to be free from both the things at the same time.
By dedication to Krishna. It's real simple. doesn't require mental adjustment, it requires devotion. So, just a, on a different but related topic, some of you participated, maybe most of you participated, in an exercise going back to the summer where we had some strategic planning exercises. Do you recall that, some of you that were here? And one of the things that we wanted to do, kind of a high priority thing that we wanted to do, was strengthen the relationships amongst the devotees. Remember that part? So, when one of the resources that we thought of engaging was Brajabihari Prabhu. Brajabihari is an amazing person. He's gifted. Krishna has given him a gift. Because Krishna has given each of us some gifts, Krishna has given him a gift of helping persons who are not close together to become closer together. He has a master's degree in conflict mediation and resolution. Anyway, he has many credentials. He does this as a service for our whole society. And we had extended an invitation for him to come in the fall of last year. Circumstantially, without the detail, it didn't happen. If a plan that was made didn't happen. And then he had a heart problem. He prepared for surgery and he had heart surgery. Now he's well again. And he's agreed to come in this year, 2012, for multiple visits. There's a limitation that he let us know. The limitation is he teaches his wife is the temple president. There's a switcheroo, huh? His wife is the temple president in our Potomac temple. And he serves our society globally as the ISKCON Resolve director and one of the ombuds persons for ISKCON and lots of other things he does. So he's teaching at the Potomac Temple a Bhakti Shastri course that's going to be every Sunday. So a number of people from the temple congregation will be attending that, and that's a commitment that he is going to keep every Sunday. So he agreed to come on a Friday afternoon and Saturday up until 4 o'clock or so, so we can catch an afternoon evening flight back to Washington, D.C., and then teach his Bhakti Shastri course on Sunday morning at the temple. So his first of a number of visits, something like 5 visits in the course of this year, will start this coming weekend. He'll come Friday sometime early afternoon and spend the day and some time with all of you in Friday evening somewhere, and then half a day up until lunch on Saturday. Hopefully he'll give a morning class and then whatever the activities will be. And the goal is to fulfill what all of you who have participated in the strategic planning said, this is really important. For our developing our strategic plan, we have to strengthen our relationships with one another so that we can work together and develop Krishna consciousness together. So it's starting. It was to start last fall. Circumstances prevented it. It's going to start in January, next weekend. He then has to go to India to take part in our meetings and do some other things. Then he'll come back and so a number of visits in the course of this year. He's a lovable person. He's very, very easy to feel very comfortable with Rajabihari. As I said, I'll say it again, he's gifted. He's very skilled. He's very wise. He just has, is very, very, we're very fortunate. I feel very fortunate that he's going to come and take up this service. He's committed, and so if you try your best to receive and a lot of what he does is, it's not just listening, lecturing type of thing. It's interactive. He'll ask you lots of questions, be lots of participation. I don't know how he's going to orchestrate it, because you know he's got his own way of doing things, and I'm sure a lot will depend on how you all express yourselves. So please come, participate as fully as your time permits, and hopefully the goal is, as we go through the rest of the year, the relationships will become stronger, obstacles will be looked at and addressed and so forth. So we have a stronger community. That's the goal, and he's Krishna's instrument to help that. I'm not expecting, and he's not expecting, he doesn't have a magic wand, and he touches things and Vaikuntha, Utopia. That's not what to be expected. But rather, some movement in a good direction. That's what I'm hoping for. Okay. I have some Mahaprasadam from a couple of different places. And I'm going to distribute some Mahaprasadam to him. I will get some.
Shri Prabhupada ki jai.